Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
The Book Program, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's book show. My first guest is Ursula Buchan. She's an award-winning journalist and author, having written 18 books. John Buchan was her grandfather. She's the daughter of his second son, William. She's drawn on recently discovered family documents to write Beyond the 39 Steps, A Life of John Buchan. Lila Cardena also hails from a literary family. Her father was a poet who battled against Franco in Spain. Her first English language novel, Becoming Insane, explores the pain, fear, and taboo surrounding mental illness. And also with us on this week's book show is Isabeau Kelm, who worked as a bookbinder in Oxford and later earned an MA in creative writing. She derives her ideas from her numerous travels and from her own biographical roots. Inspired by true events, At the Blue Hour is about a remarkable young woman who strives for power and freedom in 16th century Moldavia. Three very different books by very different authors, all on tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Dirty window, let the sun illuminate the words that you could not find. Reaching for something in the distance, so close you can almost taste it. Release your inhibitions, feel the rain on your skin. No one else can feel it for you, only you can let it in. No one else, no one else can speak the words on your lips. Drench yourself in words unspoken, live your life with.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Ursula Buchan, an award-winning journalist and author, having written 18 books. John Buchan was her grandfather, and she is a daughter of his second son, William. She is drawn on recently discovered family documents to write a comprehensive and illuminating biography called Beyond the 39 Steps, A Life of John Buchan. Welcome to the book show, Ursula.
Oh, well, thank you, Hannah, for asking me on.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's lovely to have you. And what an interesting book this must have been for you to put together, was it?
Oh, certainly, yes. Not very easy, but really, really fascinating.
Yes, I imagine there was a lot of research to be done and information got from various different sources.
Well, indeed, yes, yes. Not just the archives in Canada and in Scotland and the family papers, but a great deal of work has been done on John Buchan over the last 25 years or so by scholars and academics. And so there was a great deal to draw on. Never mind the more than 100 books that John Buchan wrote and more than 1,000 articles in magazines and newspapers and short stories and poems and political thought and even a legal textbook.
Wow, that's amazing, isn't it? So did you feel kind of added pressure because he's your a relative, your grandfather?
Well, that's an interesting question, Hannah. In some ways, it's a fantastic advantage, but in others, it's quite a disadvantage, and I had to be very careful to treat him not as my grandfather, but as a historical figure, because nobody would take me seriously if it was a work of hagiography.
Mm. At the same time, though, were you wanting to put a kind of personal touch to it, or have you tried to distance yourself as much as possible?
Well, I certainly have tried to distance myself. And in fact, it became easier and easier as time went on. But the introduction is quite personal. And I've also added an afterword when I describe going to see my grandmother in her old age, John Buchan's widow, who had a very long widowhood. And I used to go and see her in my teenage years. And I've just added a couple of pages at the end, just really so that the reader can see what happened next, I suppose.
Yes, lovely. So did you not get to meet him?
No, sadly not. He died in 1940, aged only 64. I mean, that was a number of years before I was born.
Yes, but you had a relationship with his wife.
Very much so. Yes, I did, and this book has, I think, helped to illuminate her particular predicament after he died, because he was such an extraordinary man and made such an impact, not just on people who knew him, but also in the wider world because of his books, which sold, the 39 Steps sold hundreds of thousands, if not millions of books across the world. He was such a figure in the early part of the 20th century that I think life must have been quite difficult for her after he died.
Yes. Did she express that? Did she tell you about that?
She was pretty buttoned up, I have to say. She was a reticent person from a very reticent age. I mean, these days we carry our hearts on our sleeves, but that generation, she was born in 1882, they really didn't.
No. Interesting. Do you think she would have said a lot more had it been now?
Yes. I think so. And I would have, I mean, I was so respectful. I would have felt... It would have been easier for me to ask now, I think.
Yes.
You know, but when you're a teenager and your grandmother is a very stately person, I mean, she was warm and friendly and she was very keen to know what I was doing, but she wasn't forthcoming, I don't think, about that sort of thing.
No. And for people who don't know the story of the 39 Steps, they've not read the book or not seen any of the numerous adaptations, how would you describe it? Why do you think it's done so well and continues to do so today?
Well, it's a gripping story. It's only 254 pages long, and the reader is gripped from the first page. It's a first-person narrative. It's when he introduces his hero, Richard Hannay. And, you know, from the off, it's exciting. And it also made an impact on how thrillers developed in the early part of the 20th century. Edwardian fiction was not very thrilling. And so it was really quite a new departure when it came out in 1915. And had an effect on later spy thriller writers, particularly like Ian Fleming and John le Carré. A lot of people openly admit to their debt to John Buchan.
Oh, fantastic. Very much ahead of its time then.
Well, I think so. He was a brilliant writer. He elegant, stylish, witty, but also he had this capacity to connect with all sorts of different people, and that had to do with his background, which was pretty unusual, actually, for somebody who became such a public figure. He had a way of getting on with people, and he was also a publisher, so he understood what public taste was. And his book, The 39 Steps particularly, was very popular with soldiers in the trenches.
And why unusual, his background?
Well, he was the son of a free church minister in Scotland. So though he came from an educated background, he lived the first 25 years of his life in very poor places. Firstly, an industrial parish called Parthed on the coast of Fife near Kirkcaldy. And then his teenage years were spent close to the Gorbals. His father was minister of the Free Kirk in the middle of the Gorbals, which in the 1890s was one of the worst slums in Europe. Yeah. So that's not a privileged background. He went to school in the Gorbals. He walked through it. He knew Glasgow very well. He then went to Glasgow University, again, lived at home and knew Glasgow extremely well. He would walk to his lectures 4 miles every day.
Hmm.
And so, but they spent their summer holidays in Upper Tweedale, which is a beautiful part of the Borders near Peebles, because his mother came from a line of sheep farmers. So he knew rural, beautiful rural Scotland as well, and he got to know the shepherds and the local people. So his upbringing wasn't privileged in the sense they didn't have any money, but it was rich and diverse.
Yes, fascinating. It's interesting, isn't it, to understand a bit more about people's backgrounds and to try and work out how that must have influenced their writing in some way.
Indeed. And also, he had this serious accident when he was five. A carriage wheel went over. He fell out of a carriage and a wheel went over his head, broke his skull. He had to spend the best part of a year in bed. Well, that, you know, Walter Scott and Robert Louis Stevenson both spent much of their childhood as invalids. And if you're an imaginative child, that can, you know, long hours in bed, that's when you tell yourself stories.
Mm, absolutely. And a lot of people will have come to 39 Steps from the film, the celebrated version by Alfred Hitchcock.
Yes.
Do you know how involved John was or not with the film?
Well, it's very funny, really. Hitchcock was a great admirer of his thrillers and came to him in 1934 and asked if he could film the 39 Steps. And they agreed the sum of £800.
Oh, goodness.
That was all. It cost £60,000 to make by Gaumont British.
Yeah.
And John Buchan was not involved in the screenplay, the writing of the screenplay or anything like that. And when he went to a private screening in the summer of 1935, just before it was released, he told the director of Gaumont British that it was that the film was better than the book.
Oh,
and
wow.
they'd never heard any writer ever say that before.
No.
And in fact, I mean, it's just very different. But it was sort of typical of him that he would, you know, make a sort of modest joke out of it.
Yes. Oh, fantastic. Because so often that's not the case, isn't it? I think a lot of people can relate to loving a book and then seeing the film, and most people say, oh, the film's not as good as the book.
Well, that's true. And my grandmother never forgave Alfred Hitchcock for changing the plot and introducing a female character into it.
Yes.
But Hitchcock knew, and John Buchan too, they knew what public taste was. They knew there had to be particularly if Hitchcock was to break into the American market, there would have to be a beautiful girl.
Mm.
And she was beautiful, Madeline Carroll.
Yes.
She was very beautiful. And it's one of the most famous sort of romantic comedies of the pre-war era.
Mm.
Robert Donat is Richard Hannay. It's a great film, but it's not like the book.
No, interesting. And I was fascinated to read that John was given a state funeral when he died.
He was. And the reason for that was that he was many things in his life. He was colonial administrator, he was publisher, he was journalist, he was head of propaganda towards the end of the First World War, British propaganda. He became an MP in the 1920s, so he was in the House of Commons. And then finally, they made him Governor General of Canada, so the King's representative in Canada between 1935, and in fact he died while he was still in office, and that's why he got a state funeral.
Mm.
Because he died in the early part of 1940. And yes, indeed, I mean, it was quite an event, really.
Yes. And did you, in researching the book, did you find a lot of information that you and your family weren't aware of about him?
Yes, I think so. Well, I think one thing that became very clear when I was reading the letters was just what a love match it was, his marriage to my grandmother. They came from very different social spheres. She was of a English aristocratic family. She was a Grosvenor. And he really wasn't from that kind of milieu at all. But it's plain that they really loved each other. And actually, that makes, at the heart of this book is a pretty touching love story.
Oh, that must be nice to read that.
Yes, yes. I mean, they're quite restrained. I mean, you have to read between the lines a bit.
Yes.
but their mutual affection is absolutely obvious, and it lasted their lifetime.
Mm. And do you remember growing up as a child being aware of who your grandfather was and what he had done? When did it sort of hit you?
Well, yes, I was, and the books were on the shelves, and I was told, you know, stories about, you know, how he, you know, had a stroke and fell and hit his head, and how, you know, the valiant efforts that the doctors made to save his life and all of that. I heard all that, but what really struck me was I was about 9 or 10, and my twin sister and I went to play bingo for the first time in the village hall, in the village in Oxfordshire where we lived. And we were fascinated by these numbers being pulled out of the bag, you know, 11, legs 11, 21, key to the door, 39, all the steps. And I've talked to my sister about it. She remembers it as vividly as I do. We were very, very struck that this book that we thought somehow had to do with our family was famous enough to be a bingo call.
Oh, isn't that wonderful? What a lovely story.
Never forgotten.
No, I bet. That's fabulous. If you'd like to find out any more about the life of John Buchan, then you must get a copy of the book. It's called Beyond the 39 Steps, A Life of John Buchan, and it's by his granddaughter, Ursula Buchan, who we've been chatting to today. Ursula, thank you very much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure, Hannah. Thank you very much indeed.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray. The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now in Switzerland is Leila Cardina, who was born in Geneva in Switzerland and hails from a literary family. She has published her first novel in French in 2013 and is with us on the book show now to talk about her first English language novel. It's called Becoming Insane, and it explores the pain, fear and taboos surrounding mental illness. Welcome to the book show, Leila.
Hello, thank you very much to have me here.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for joining us. And well done for publishing a novel in English, with French as your native language, I assume.
Yes, it is. I'm actually bilingual. My mother and grandmother are British, so I was born with those two languages.
Oh, fantastic. And did you find it okay writing the novel? Was it just as easy as writing it in French then?
Well, it came, let's say I imagined it already in English. It really depends. It's a bit strange. Some stories, I imagine them in French, some others in English. Maybe it's because the story takes place in New York. That's why I wrote it in English.
Yeah.
But also the English language is much simpler than the French language.
And where did you get the idea from? You're talking a lot about mental illness, and you've had a lot of experience both with you and your friends in the past.
Mm-hmm. Well, the characters, John Crane and Jack Vane, were already created in 2014, and I wrote the story in 2016. So they became two aspects of myself. They have their own personality, of course, but they lived with me, if I may say so, and they are two parts of me. And I think that the fact that the story takes place in the end of the 80s, which means that they were born in the end of the 50s, is very significant, also in regards to mental illness. They are, first of all, the latest generation of the people that immigrated to America. So they are Americans, but their origins, like John Crane, he's Polish, and Jack Vane is Italian. So there's also a social background to them. For example, they live in the same neighborhood, and they share a lot of things with the kids that also have different origins, that live in the same neighborhood, street kids. They represent really this having to struggle a lot when you are in lack of material things. For example, money or things like that that could help them. I never, for example, me and my friends, we could not follow school in a traditional way because we knew that without money, without this or without that, it would be impossible. Either we worked and studied or we waited. So we're at the same time being plunged into adult responsibility while at the same time having to struggle with our own teenage emotions.
Mm.
And sometimes that can be difficult. You see, it's very difficult to know that, for example, I knew a girl once. She was just an acquaintance, but she was already at 15 years old out of her mother's house. So where could she go apart to a boyfriend? She could only go there, find a job or do this or do that. And for a city, like, for example, Geneva, that we imagine with all its banks, the lake, the chocolates, etc., I can understand that people from another country may have a hard time to imagine that, but that's true. We have a lot of people that do not have a lot of money here in this city.
And I understand growing up as well, you saw various friends of yours as teenagers who were committed to psychiatric care.
Yes, well, either like in the specialized school where I went, and sometimes I saw girls, I think I was 14 or 15, who were there because they didn't have any other place to go.
Gosh.
And as they were, you know, rebellious and they didn't want to go to school, well, they went there and, you know, asked for a certificate from the doctor and stayed there until they felt strong enough, or I would say, ready and strong enough to be able to go to work or go back to school or things like that. And this is a sort of Geneva that we don't see.
Mm, absolutely. And do you feel then people were put in these institutions not because they necessarily had mental health issues, but because there was no one else to kind of look after them normally?
Yes, I think it's a mix of the two. Because how can a teenager with all of the hormones and the rebellious, emotions, be able to take on school and then a job or anything else or even find a subject that they love if their parents, you know, don't really look after them? But also it's not the fault of the parents, not all of them, let's say, because they themselves are people who have to work 24/7 for very little salary.
Oh, it's a terrible situation. Has it got better, do you think?
Now, for example, I signed my apprenticeship contract when I was 16 years old, And that was the norm, that you were 15 years old, you either went, for example, to commercial school 100%, or you would follow an apprenticeship and go to school 3 to 2 times a week, and you were 15, and back then, at 18 years old, you're professional. You're completely ready to tackle on, you know, a real job and be a real employee. And what I discovered when I was 18 and when I became a real employee in a trust company is that there were more and more youngsters that were beginning an apprenticeship at 22, 23. So for me, that would mean that, for example, they may have had much more free time in their teenage years to really, you know, think about what they want to do. And then later on, either go back to school fully if they can, depending on their results in exams, or do an apprenticeship.
Mm.
And it also depends on what bosses want. Some people would prefer that a youngster has more discipline and professional and a professional background than just school, because they don't necessarily have the time to always be behind a young employee.
Yeah.
They need someone that knows what to do and when to do it.
Yeah.
So it depends also on the needs of the companies that exist.
So going back to the book just briefly, you mentioned the characters earlier, John Crane and Jack Vane. Can you tell us a little bit more about them and what happens in the story without giving the main plot away?
Well, they are, I would say, adults, first of all, that are unrealized in a certain way. And they are the perfect opposite of each other. One, John Crane has taken the risk of leaving a job, a normal job, to concentrate himself 100% on his writing and publish. But this dream never comes true. And the other, Jack Vane, has always designed to work in animation, and he draws, he paints, but he dares not to leave his job. He's married, he has 2 kids, so he's frustrated and feels much more responsible. And even if he has saved some money, he just cannot, let's say, build up the strength to say to his family, listen, I'd like to take 1 year sabbatical, see if I can do this or that. For me, it's more of a, the situation is more of a symbol where one has completely left, I would say, the normal world of having to get up in the morning, go to a job, then come home to write and follow his dream, because this is also the message that we hear always. Follow your dream, do what you want to do, and that's it. And the other one, Jack Vane, is completely imprisoned in his own life, the life that he has constructed for himself, and he doesn't know how to get out. And so between the two, then there's a need of balance. How do you follow a dream when you're an adult? You're not as young as you were, and still be able to be there for other people and take responsibility. That's what those two characters represent, at least in the beginning of the story.
Yeah. And do you think there's going to be a follow-up, or is it a standalone novel?
There will be a follow-up, because it ends in a cliffhanger. So, yes, there's going to be a follow-up that will explore a bit more about flashbacks, the young adult years of those two characters and also their sexual development.
Okay, fantastic. So lots of big subjects that you're tackling.
Yes, well, I love those characters so much that I tried to put at least one or two subjects that were, I would say, would give them justice, not just anything.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, if people want to get a copy of the book, it's called Becoming Insane, and it's by Leila Cardena, who we've been chatting to. They can get a copy of the book from our website in the bookshop section on tre.radio. Leila Cardena, thank you very much for joining us, and best of luck with the book.
Thank you very much.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray. Talk Radio Europe. The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from Madrid is Isabeau Kelm, who completed her bachelor's degree programme in art history, worked as a bookbinder in Oxford, and later earned an MA in creative writing. She derives her ideas from her numerous travels and from her personal interest in her own biographical roots. And she lives in Madrid, which we're talking to her from now. And she's with us on the book show to talk about her latest book. It's called At the Blue Hour, inspired by true events. It's the story of a remarkable young woman who strives for power and freedom in 16th century Moldavia. Welcome to the show, Isabeau.
Thank you very much, Hannah. Oh, I'm very glad to be here.
It's lovely to have you with us. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And what took you to Madrid? How long have you been there for?
Well, I've been here since October last year. And I've actually followed my fiancé, who has family here in Madrid. And we have a small child together. She's 1 year and 2 months now. And we figured that it is much easier for us to live in Madrid with his family here than in Amsterdam, where we lived previously.
Yes, lovely. And you're enjoying it?
Very, very much. I just love the Spanish culture. I love the Spanish food. The Spanish mentality, yes, I just love it. And the weather, of course.
Yes, absolutely. That's great. So looking at your book, At the Blue Hour, inspired a little bit by true events and also looking at your own family history. Tell us about your family history, can you?
Yes, of course. Well, it is kind of complicated. So I belong to the ethnic minority in Siberia. So my family has been living in Siberia since, I think, 1780, right? So, but we remained an ethnic minority throughout, even in the Soviet Union. So we were considered Germans in Siberia. Then we were re-expatriated to Germany, to Trier, to be precise. It's the oldest city in Germany. And, well, there we are considered to be Russians, you know. So all my life, actually, I've been struggling with identity issues.
Yeah.
And this is exactly what my protagonist is struggling with as well, you know, because, first of all, she's based on a true historical figure, Irina Botesata, which means Irina the Baptized. And, well, her mother is of Venetian descendant. And her father is a Romani gypsy, and she grew up in a Romani gypsy slave camp. So, you know, we have some parallels in our life.
It's interesting because it's such a fascinating background and history that you have, and it should be such a positive, wonderful thing to embrace, but to not be able to kind of identify exactly where you come from and your roots and what that means must be, as you say, very difficult.
It is difficult and liberating at the same time, you know what I mean? It is, you know, first I struggled with the idea, and I was always looking for a place where I belong, but I've lived in so many countries and I've experienced so many different mentalities, and I actually feel as, you know, as curious as it sounds, like a war, like a citizen of the world, if I might say so, you know. And actually, the whole world is my home now.
How lovely!
But my protagonist Irina doesn't really understand this at this age because she's quite young in the first novel. Well, because you know, it is a series. Actually, I've already written the second book. which is only available in German right now.
Okay. Oh, that's brilliant. But how lovely. What a great thing to be able to say that you're a citizen of the world.
Well, yes, I think so.
Good for you, putting a beautiful positive spin on it, definitely.
Thank you.
So tell me a little bit more about this character in the book.
Well, as I said, her mother is Venetian, well, actually from the Venetian aristocracy. But I don't want to say too much. I don't want to spoil her anything. But she somehow ends up in a Moldavian gypsy camp or a Romani camp. Yes, of the Orthodox Church. And Irina's father is a Romani gypsy. So all her life, her mother gave her the idea that she needs to strive for more in her life, you know what I mean? To get out of the slave camp, to make something out of her life, you know. And her mother gave her the idea of happiness, true happiness, and true freedom can only be found in, in the form of a man, really, you know, that helps her to escape, you know, a wealthy, powerful man. And then really she meets this character called Cornelius, who is the mage and advisor of the prince of Moldavia. And he introduces her to the secret sciences, you know, and so she gains this wealth of knowledge. But she realizes that this knowledge doesn't lead her to wealth, you know. And so, well, I don't know whether you could call it luck or so, but the Prince of Moldavia actually falls in love with her. And this is really based on true events. Mm. And he frees her from slavery and takes her to his castle and really falls in love with her. But the question now is, does she really find freedom there in wealth and supposed power?
Yeah.
You know, or is it more knowledge? And what is actually freedom? You know, what is personal freedom? And, I just would like to say to my readers that I see my work as a joint creation, you know, because I'm raising a lot of questions that I myself cannot really answer, you know, so I try to create a spiritual connection with my readers, so maybe we all can find some answers to the many questions that life gives us.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was doing a bit of research before our chat today. I wanted to try and understand a little bit more about Moldavia because I felt like I'd heard of it but couldn't quite place it in history. And Moldavia doesn't exist now. Parts of it are in Romania and the other parts of it have become Moldova. Is that correct?
Exactly. Yeah. Yes, yes. Moldavia is really the old definition of this part of Romania and Moldavia and Ukraine
as well. Yes. Okay. And this book is set in the late 16th century.
Yes, exactly. It's she was born in 1568, and when the story really starts to it's about 15 and it's 1583.
Yes. Okay.
And it was a very exciting time because at the time, Moldavia was really part of the Ottoman Empire. Mm-hmm. And the prince really didn't have so much power as we really think, because the Sultan was the real emperor of Wallachia, Transylvania, Moldavia. So, yes, oftentimes the princes of Moldavia and Wallachia and Transylvania had to pay tribute to the Sultan or had to bribe the Sultan to actually gain the throne.
Mm. It must have been fascinating doing all the research for this, was it?
It was very fascinating and very difficult.
Oh, really?
Very, very difficult. Yes, because there are virtually no historical sources about Irina Botetate's childhood. So I could not make use of any primary historical sources, you know, I could not go to archives because, first of all, I do not speak the Old Moldavian, which is written in an old version of Cyrillic alphabet. I mean, I do, I can read the Cyrillic alphabet, well, because, you know, I was born in Russia, but the Moldavian version of it in the 16th century was quite different, first of all. Mm. Second of all the books that are, you know, that... well, that are about this topic are written in Romanian, a language which I do not speak. And, well, when I wrote the book at that time, I did not have the means to actually travel to Romania and, you know, go through, go to the archives and stuff like that. But it doesn't mean that I did not do any research at all. I mean, I really tried my best. And there were quite a few secondary historical sources online, and also about the Romani culture, where I found a lot of books and libraries. And really, the Romani culture is very, very fascinating.
Mm.
So, yeah, I did a lot of research in libraries and online, where we are very lucky as historical novelists that a lot of... well, old books have been archived, so we can, you know, still read them. And of course, I mean, as foolish as it sounds, Google Translate always helps.
So absolutely, definitely use whatever means necessary.
Exactly. And I would also like to stress that I am a historical novelist, you know, and not a historian.
Yeah.
So, I mean, of course, I took the historical facts that I could find as a departure point to create a story, you know, that is more about self-exploration and about the exploration of the idea of freedom.
Sure.
Really, you know. So I would actually call my novel a Bildungsroman. So basically a, you know, like coming of age story. Mm-hmm. With some hints of magical realism set in the past.
Beautifully explained.
Thank you.
You mentioned that you're in the process of writing a second book, a follow-up to this.
I actually have finished it already, but it's only okay. Available in German so far.
Ah, yes. Okay.
Yeah, but it will soon be translated into English.
Great.
And I am already actually working on the third book as well. So it will be a trilogy.
Fantastic. So you write in German then, do you?
Yes, I have written these historical novels in German, but I also have a second pen name, which is I.W. Silke, where I explore my own family history. So I would say under this other second pen name, I'm more of a creative nonfiction writer.
Okay. So with your fiancé being
yes.
Spanish, do you speak Spanish with him or English?
Well, I mean, as we have only moved here last October, we primarily speak in English. I have to admit to my shame. But,
no, not at all. You're speaking enough languages with the Russian and Dutch, presumably.
And yes, I do. Yeah, but I actually go to a language school here every Saturday. And I think I've improved a lot. And I am able to converse with people on the street, you know, as long as it's a basic conversation. But I am telling my fiance every day, let's speak Spanish, you know, and then we naturally switch to English anyway.
Oh, well done. I think it is very impressive, people who speak lots of different languages. It's some people really struggle trying to learn a second language, but with people who speak a handful,
it's amazing.
Well,
I just love learning languages and, you know, love exploring other cultures. I just love it.
Yeah.
I think it's in my blood, really.
Absolutely. Well, if people want to get a copy of your latest book, it's called At the Blue Hour. It's by Isabeau Kelm, who we've been chatting to today. People can get a copy from our website in the TRE bookshop section. Isabeau, thank you so much for joining us and best of luck with the book.
Thank you so much for letting me speak at your radio station and wishing you all the best.
The Book Program, presented by Hannah Murray.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this program, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.